Welcome, listeners. This is Karen, and I'm coming to you from the Talking Information Center. Today's date is August 20th, 2026, and I will be reading the Dorchester Reporter. I'll start with the first article. Eversource volunteers return to lend a hand at the food project in Dorchester. About 25 Eversource employees traded their regular workday for weeding, harvesting, and greenhouse chores in Dorchester on Thursday morning as they joined youth interns and staff from the food project for a second consecutive year of volunteer work. The employees spent the morning working alongside the food project team on its urban farm, tending growing areas and helping harvest produce, while also pitching in at the end of season work in the greenhouse. The return engagement follows a similar volunteer effort last August, when Eversource employees spread out among several of the Food Project's Dorchester growing sites to harvest crops, clear the greenhouse, and prepare garden beds for neighborhood residents. Jim Hunt, Eversource's executive vice president and a longtime Dorchester resident, said the company sees the relationship as a natural extension of its ties to the neighborhood. Dorchester has deep roots for Eversource, and we are proud to continue our partnership with the Food Project and support the important work they do to this community, Hunt said. Their commitment to expanding access to fresh, healthy food, supporting young people, and building stronger communities makes this a natural partnership for us, he added. These are our neighbors and our employees, and value the opportunity to get out of the office, work together, and give back to the communities we serve. The Food Project has operated in Massachusetts since 1991, bringing together young people and adults to grow fresh produce while working to improve access to healthy, affordable food. Its Boston operations include farms and growing spaces in Dorchester and Roxbury, and programs that give young people hands-on experience in agriculture, food systems, and community service. Last year, the Food Project staff told the reporter that large groups of volunteers can be particularly useful during labor-intensive portions of the growing season. In August 2025, Eversource workers helped remove tomato vines and clean the Dudley Street greenhouse during its seasonal shutdown, filled raised beds on North Avenue, and harvested crops at the organization's Langdon Street farm. This year's volunteers again worked directly alongside the Food Project's youth interns and staff, with the late summer timing putting them to work on both harvesting and preparing growing spaces for the next stage of the season. For Eversource, Hunt said, returning for a second year underscores a relationship the company hopes to continue. These are our neighbors, he said, and our employees value the opportunity to get out of the office, work together, and give back to the communities we serve. Our next story. In first Suffolk contest, tax debate remains the focus for Collins and Gale. At a virtual candidate forum for the first Suffolk State Senate primary election held last Wednesday, August 12th, by the Massachusetts Affordable Homeowners Alliance, no one asked about property tax relief, but the incumbent Nick Collins brought it up anyway. The very next day, the topic boomeranged against him in an Instagram post by one of his Democratic challengers, Latoya Gale, in which she cited the truth about his voting record on the issue. Whether upfront or tacit, the combined political exchange was herky-jerky, spliced over different platforms for a scatter of followings. The updated feed reflected an age-old dilemma for voters, a conflict between position and practice. If I'm reelected again, I'm going to commit the same level of passion as I have in the past and raising two young girls in the city, Collins said, trying to ensure the Massachusetts Affordable Housing Ownership Alliance Forum participants. And my wife and I know how hard it is to own a home and to maintain our footing, and also to continue to work to lower the tax burden on people, particularly working families, seniors, as we have passed significant legislation to do that. Touted by Collins as tax relief for senior, the legislation was an amendment passed by the state Senate for a second time this year in June. If approved by the House of Representatives and the governor, it would increase the property tax exemption for eligible homeowners with higher eligibility ceilings on assets and income for seniors. In a Collins press relief, he suggested that the relief could be provided with the city's surplus funds. As he detailed in a later Instagram post, the legislation triples the property tax exemption for seniors, triples the personal property tax exemption for small businesses, authorizes the use of surplus funds for direct homeowner rebates. Though similar to an item that was filed last year by the Massachusetts Municipal Association, as well as a city order approved in June, the amendment has met with mixed reaction from Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. She acknowledged that it could help some homeowners living on fixed incomes, but WBUR reported that she opposed drawing tax relief from the city's revenue surplus money that she insists should be used only for emergencies. In a letter to Wu on July 23rd, Collins pointed out that the city's reserve fund was more than three times larger than previously reported. That surplus was built up by the tax dollars of Bostonians, he contended, and it presents an opportunity to provide meaningful relief. In the city's June 30th announcement of the local order, the source of money for tax relief is unspecified. And according to the executive director of the Boston Policy Institute, Gregory Maynard, either form of new tax relief would amount to foregone revenue, with differences over the drawdown being immaterial to the policy that's on the table. Collins and Wu have been at odds over relief since 2024, when slumping values in downtown commercial real estate shifted more of the property tax burden to the residential class, including some longtime house-rich owners living on a fixed income. We tried to soften the blow on residential owners through a home rule measure that would adjust rates temporarily, similar to one supported 20 years ago, earlier by former Mayor Tom Menino. Her measure was quickly opposed by real estate and property groups. At the end of 2024, after shifting projections of the tax burden, it also faced opposition from Collins and one other state senator representing part of Boston, William N. Brownsberger. The two Democratic senators are currently facing primary challenges from candidates supported by Wu. Though the home rule measure has failed to advance at the State House, Wu still maintains that it would provide even more relief to residential property owners. And Collins's challenger, Gail, reinforced that message one day after the Maha Forum in that Instagram clip that showed her displaying a promotion of the Senate amendment in a piece of Collins' campaign literature. "You may have gotten this in the mail," Gail wrote, "but I'm here to tell you the truth. Senator Collins is claiming to fight to lower your property tax bills, but the truth is, when the city of Boston put forth a tax shift proposal that would have saved the city $150 million over the last 2 years, that's $8 million in South Boston, $8 million in Dorchester, $2 million in Roxbury." The senator blocked it. In April of 2024, when Wu announced her home rule measure, one of the speakers at her briefing was Maha's executive director, Simone Crawford. And at a mayoral forum last year, Maha members showed enthusiasm for Wu's commitment to extend city support for its homebuyer programs, in addition to backing legislation to increase funding for housing. A year later, there was no question about tax relief at Maha's state senate forum, as Collins, Gale, and second-time challenger Juwan Skeens were largely in agreement about the group's housing agenda. But Maha's treasurer and board member, Aisha Adams Heath, pressed Collins on earlier reservations about a proposed real estate transfer fee, which had been advanced by several groups to raise new revenue for affordable housing. The fee would apply to transaction values above $2 million. In 2024, the Senate Ways and Means Committee, including Collins, played a key role in dropping a version of the transfer fee from a capital spending package in the wake of stiff opposition by real estate and property owner groups. In response at the forum, Collins said he now favored the fee as a local option, with more flexibility on how the new revenue could be disbursed, potentially for programs such as Maha's Stash, which offers down payment help for the first time generation homebuyers. In other versions of the transfer fee, revenue would have channeled through a local housing, community housing trust. The flexibility to sometimes bypass the Affordable Housing Trust to give funds right to programs like Stash, Collins explained, has changed my outlook that it can actually go right to the work that needs to get done. A next story. Shoma Tunnel Cap thrives with this couple's embrace. The author is Seth Daniel. It might be a smile brought about by a sunflower waving in the wind along the side of the walkway headed to the Shawmut station, or perhaps it's the scent of a daylily picked up while cutting through the same walkway from Mather Street to Melville Avenue. In both cases and more, the flowers and plants in the Shawmut Corridor Gardens, also known as the Tunnel Cap Gardens, don't just sprout up on their own. They are the result of work done by and sanctioned and unsanctioned neighborhood volunteer gardeners over the course of 50 years, most recently by Melville Park couple Ken Bloomberg and Sarah Weinstein, who are stepping away to let others take charge of the shovels and rakes. I'm realizing that as we get older and our joints get cracking, it's time to bring in new people, said Sarah. I hate to see this die because it's become an incredible asset. Jenny Moy Gibbons, also a resident of Melville Park, said that the Weinsteins have been involved with the Tunnel Cap before she stepped in during the 1990s and early 2000s. When her life got busy 15 years ago, they took over. She noted they'd done a great job organizing the monthly neighbor cleanups and weeding Wednesdays, as well as a new initiative to bring in volunteers from the nonprofit Boston Cares to assist. All the while, Sarah has been lending her gardening expertise to the effort for more than a decade. I am so grateful to her and Ken for keeping it going all these years. Sarah said that she and Ken, they moved to the area in the late 1970s, not long after he had returned from service in Vietnam, and began to raise a family. Both were attuned to nature and environmental issues, from working for government environmental agencies at the state and federal level. At the time, the MBTA had just started to serve the Ashmont line with 6-car trains instead of the 2- and 4-car trains that had long traveled the route. And then in the 1980s, when they built out the tunnel cap, she and other neighbors began the gardens with a whim and a stem. It literally started because I had too many daylilies for our yard, and we dug them into the sides of the cap, Sarah said. When they redid the walkway in 1980s, they painted it with a waterproof paint with sand in it, and it wrinkled like an elephant skin. We wondered why the end of the red line on our side couldn't be as nice as it was in Cambridge. We kept pushing them for a 3-block walkway and to see the whole picture and go beyond the station, she recalled. In 2008, When Chalmette Station was renovated, volunteers pushed to get a nicer hardscape on the tunnel cap and to get a better partnership and plot for the gardens. Though the MBTA was hesitant at first, then State Rep Marty Walsh was helpful in getting movement in the right direction, and someone at the city level pushed it as well, producing what now has become the Tunnel Cap Gardens. The T did come around, and it was a huge success, and they're become pretty good partners, Sarah said. Since then, we've been working, and we've had the great fortune to add terrific volunteers from Boston Care. They have sent us hundreds of people that sign up because they want to contribute to the community and like being outside. Sarah and Ked said the plantings have been an experiment. Some plantings work and others don't because the cap is just a shallow tunnel cover and there isn't the perfect ecology to make all things thrive. They recalled some plants that are 20 years old. Then there is an elderberry bush that everybody really wanted along the edges, but it just couldn't cope. Meanwhile, another elderberry nearby that was less desired took off and is now 10 feet tall. On August 1st, neighborhood volunteers and tunnel cap crew gathered for their monthly cleanup and also held an organizational meeting to discuss getting new volunteers to take the lead from the Weinsteins in 2027. So far, there's been a good response, but more volunteers are being sought. Our next article, SJC ruling clears the way for city's controversial white stadium project by Bill Forey. In a major victory for Mayor Michelle Wu, the state's highest court ruled Wednesday in favor of the City of Boston and its private soccer team partners in the long-running legal battles over the redevelopment of White Stadium, clearing a major legal obstacle facing the controversial Franklin Park project. In the 36-page decision, the Supreme Judicial Court upheld the city's position in a case brought by the Emerald Necklace Conservancy and a group of residents known as the Franklin Park Defenders who had challenged the planned public-private redevelopment of the historic stadium. The ruling leaves intact a Suffolk Superior Court decision issued in April 2025 that sided with the city and Boston Unity Soccer Partners, the ownership group behind Boston Legacy FC, the city's National Women's Soccer League franchise. Superior Court Judge Matthew Nestor had concluded that the White Stadium parcel was not protected parkland for purposes of Article 97 of the Massachusetts Constitution. Today's ruling affirms Nestor's decision. Finally, we conclude that the plaintiff's challenges to the proposed use of areas within Franklin Park, but outside the stadium parcel fail, the justices wrote. They also rejected a key premise of the legal challenge writing. We first conclude that the plaintiffs have no cognizable individual interest in the Robert White Fund or Trust, and therefore do not have standing to challenge the alleged violations of its provisions. The long-awaited SJC ruling has been pending since April, when justices heard arguments from both sides in a Boston courtroom. The case is an appeal of an earlier decision from a Suffolk Superior Court judge who ruled in favor of the City of Boston and Boston Unity Soccer Partners. The plaintiffs, led by the Emerald Necklace Conservancy and a group of neighbors known as Franklin Park Defenders, appealed that ruling. The White Stadium project has been the subject of fierce opposition from some quarters, including some nearby residents who object to the potential impact of game day parking and traffic restrictions. Others object to what they have characterized as the misuse of a public park for a private enterprise. The Wu administration has steadfastly argued that the benefits of the agreement far outweigh any sacrifice of public use, citing in particular the upside of having a state-of-the-art athletic facility that will be mainly used by Boston Public School student athletes for more than 300 days a year. Mayor Wu said it was a decision that cleared the way for a big investment in the city and its young people. Today's clear and unanimous decision from the state's highest court confirms that Boston student athletes, park lovers, and community will fully benefit from this landmark investment in our future without further delay. Renovations at White Stadium in Franklin Park are well underway to deliver a state-of-the-art facility that will be available in every season. This is a great victory for our city and for all who believe that Boston can and should take big swings to get things done for our community. Senator Liz Miranda, Democrat of Roxbury, whose district includes Franklin Park, said Wednesday that while the court has cleared the way for the White Stadium to move forward, that cannot be the end of the conversation. Our community has rightful concerns, said Miranda in a statement to the reporter. We have seen what can happen, even on a smaller scale, at Carter Playground. It is still a public park, but many Roxbury residents don't feel like that space is for them anymore. We cannot let that happen at White Stadium. There are still real concerns about transportation, parking, access, and the impact on Franklin Park's surrounding neighborhoods. Those conversations need to continue. Karen Monney Brodeck, president of the Emerald Necklace Conservancy, that sued the city and franchise, said, "We are disappointed by this outcome. There is still time to transition to a smaller but fully public project that would be better for Boston students, the public, and local residents. Such a project would be much more affordable, would not displace previous owners and users of the playing field like BPS football program, would not negatively impact existing park users and neighbors, and from a maintenance perspective, would be significantly more sustainable long term." A statement released by the Boston Legacy FC's controlling owner, Jennifer Epstein, called the ruling a tremendous victory for Boston Public School students, the Franklin Park community, and the future of professional women's soccer in Boston. The court's decision clears the way for completing the White Stadium renovation. District 7 Councilor Minyard Culpepper, whose district includes White Stadium, said his focus has not been on the legal fight, saying the White Stadium issues had become too politicized. Instead, he's been focusing on contracting job opportunities for the community. "We are doing pretty good with contracting, and the last piece we hope to do much better," he told the reporter in an interview. "My vote has really been on making sure black and brown contractors get their fair share, and we'll continue to push on that. The first goal for me was to get as much as we can and make the owners, Boston Unity Soccer Partners, live up to the 50% goal. The question for me is, how do we drive more dollars to Boston's more vulnerable communities and close the racial wealth gap?" He also noted that the effort has resulted in the procurement readiness pilot program with the city and Suffolk University to make sure black and brown contractors are prepared to scale up to compete for large contracts like this in the future. From the arts section, Boston Lights, A Lantern Experience is back at the Franklin Park Zoo by Cassidy McNeely. It began last Friday. After the animals at the Franklin Park Zoo headed to bed for the night, visitors headed into the zoo, where they had dream-like experiences of their own as they wandered through scenes inspired by coastal South Africa, the Grand Canyon, and ocean depths. Boston Lights, A Lantern Experience, the popular summer and fall tradition, was back in Dorchester, beginning a Thursday through Monday run that will conclude in early November. "We are in partnership with Tianyu Arts and Culture Incorporated," said Stephanie Brindley, Zoo New England CEO and president. "We're hosting Boston Lights, which is a Chinese lantern festival. It's quite extensive. We have well over 1,000 individual lanterns and more than 40 different vignettes or scenes. With a 1.5 mile path, guests travel through 100-foot-long lantern tunnels inspired by bamboo and peacock feathers and enter an underworld water of colorful tropical fish and great white sharks, or a desert where they are greeted by a Gila monster and burrowing owls. There's something for everybody, said Brindley. We are just really excited. This is the 7th year that we've offered it, and we're excited to see this become a tradition that families come back to over and over again. Each year brings a new set of lanterns created in Zhejiang, China, the lantern capital of the world, and delivered to Dorchester. According to Jiang Guanghong, a master artisan of Zhejiang lantern art, when they are assembled upon arrival, there is a sort of second creation. With the help of translator Jesse Lee, Guanghong, 45, told the reporter that Chinese lantern making has been a vibrant art form for more than 1,000 years that embodies Chinese philosophy, symbolism, and communal celebration. Since the skills required to make these lanterns include complex farming, intricate knot tying, and delicate silk painting, all have been preserved through a master apprentice system, Guanghong felt feels a series of sense of responsibility to pass down the tradition and bring it to other parts of the world. But after 20 years of working with the lanterns, he isn't just passing down his knowledge, he is adding to it. This year he was excited about the incorporation of interactive elements, like the talking parakeet and the live chat screen. Guanghong's goal is for Boston Lights to not just be something you see, but be something, rather, that you experience. And with the addition of music, movement, and even conversation, he thinks his team has accomplished just that. That's all the time we have for our broadcast. Thank you for joining me, and thank you for tuning in to the Talking Information Center.